Welcome to the Celery Report. Today is March 13th, 2014. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and tonight we're going to have a conversation about the breakaway economy, part two. If you haven't read the annual wrap-up that we did in January, I really hope you'll take a look at it, particularly the web presentation or the transcript, because we have wonderful charts. I describe in the beginning of the annual wrap-up a process whereby all of the money that has been pulled out of the developed economies as part of what I describe as the financial coup d'etat is being reinvested. And essentially we have, from a very high level, a process where we're taking enormous amounts of capital out of the industrial model. I refer to it as Global 2.0, and shifting it into Global 3.0, which is a model defined by integration of new information and digital technology in a wide spectrum of technology. And it's a model that is also globalized. So it is much more global and it is much more digital. So think of it as going from an industrial economy to a networked economy, but I describe it as Global 2.0 and 3.0. And to give you a sense of the magnitude of the capital flows, we put together a chart that showed some of the money, which I believe has been pulled from one to the other. Another very important chart in that wrap-up is the chart that shows the extraordinary acceleration in the last 2 years of people all around the world getting smartphones and getting online. So between smartphones and tablets, we have almost 2 billion people online. Literally last year, 1 billion smartphones shipped, if we can imagine that. And so what that means is, in the 1990s, we began a process of globalizing the labor supply so that literally we in America are competing with labor in China, so to speak. So, and that process began with a real bang in the mid-90s after we implemented the World Trade Organization, the Uruguay Round of GATT. Now, that process continues, but what this means with literally 2 billion people now online is we're about to start to reorganize the consumer in the same way that we organized labor. In Breakaway Part 1, 2 weeks ago, I talked about who is the breakaway civilization, and how is it kind of organized from who's doing this point of view. Tonight I want to look in part two at what is it? What does it mean in the different parts of the economy? What's being invested in and what are the risks? I'm going to divide my comments into three main sections. The first is what I would call opportunities and risk for investors. And when I say investors, I mean both the investment of our time and money. So it's not just investing in stocks and bonds. It's the full spectrum of our time and money, whether it's our own business or how we manage our household, as well as our assets and how we manage assets, including liquid assets. So the first section is opportunities and risk for investors. Then I want to talk a little bit about what I call mysteries and wildcards, the big questions. And then finally, I want to talk about the key strategic choices. And what you're going to see, and what I'm going to come back to in the last section, is that there are two very important cross-cutting themes. If you have ever done scenario planning or certain kinds of strategic designing, what you try and pull out are the key variables and the relationship between them that will drive future scenarios. And two very important variables are, number one, a change in consciousness, and number two, a change in technology. So, for example, when you bring 2 billion people online and you create one consumer market, no longer is North America the biggest consumer market or the European Union the biggest consumer market. It's people with access to the internet on smartphones are the biggest consumer market. And what you literally get is you get 2 billion people who can now communicate with each other, who can share the same field, share the same psychic storm. So you have the potential for an enormous change in consciousness along with this change in technology. And I think what is going to happen is very much depending on how we 8 to 9 billion people choose in terms of those two spectrums. Do we go to a lower mind or a higher mind? Do we stay low tech? Do we go high tech? How do we adapt that technology? And that's particularly where the higher mind versus lower mind is very important. Opportunities and risk for investors. I want to look at the opportunities for us as whether it's investing our time or our money in three critical areas. First, I want to look at sectors of the economy. I'm going to focus more on the developed world because it looks different in the developed worlds than the emerging world or emerging markets. So I'm going to look at sectors. Then I'm going to look at places. And there's an enormous place-based component to what's going to happen in the sort of breakaway economy. And then I want to look at a few rules of thumb, which are very important for you to understand about how to approach investment in this kind of environment. Okay, so let's turn to sectors. And I want to start with some of the most important ones. I think if I had to pick one sector that was a driver, it would be energy. And of course, there are great question marks in this energy. Energy is a critical component of all productivity, whether it's the cost of household or the cost of business. And so, for example, we've talked with Jim Norman in the oil card interviews that he's done about the importance of oil, its role. Literally, our global currency is the dollar is the global reserve currency, is tied to the equivalent of a petrodollar standard. So control of the oil and gas and fossil fuel energy industry has been critical to the financial model and control of the financial model. So there's a very intimate connection between money and energy. But as we've talked with Jim Norman, the oil and gas price and the management of it has been critical to sort of economic warfare and economic control. If you haven't listened to those interviews, I strongly recommend them. And we've talked about the importance domestically in North America of bringing the oil and gas price down and using that to attract back a lot of industry and sort of begin to re-industrialize and reinvent the manufacturing base. And one of the things Jim's talked about is that the fact that the manufacturing cost, the biggest component is energy. It's not labor, it's energy. So energy cross-cuts everything, and you can't change the energy model without changing the financial model. It's also hard to change the financial model without changing the energy model, and so it's very important to look at these two things. When people talk to me about renewable energy or free energy, I always say, look, if we're going to talk about this, we have to talk about the financial model, which means we have to talk about the governance model, because the three of them are all very much part of one thing. So one way to say it is, if you're going to change the energy model, you run the risk of the reinvention of everything. We currently have a very mixed model. The policy leadership within the breakaway economy or the people leading it want 1,000 flowers to bloom. So we have oil and gas plus renewables plus nuclear. A lot is being encouraged to encourage a robust source of energy for now. And one of the things that's happening, a lot of money and subsidies being put into renewables. And as that happens, renewables are becoming more economic. Part of getting them to really sustainable economics is the storage and battery question. We're seeing a lot of new articles now that that battery storage and is becoming economic in that vein. If we should hit a tipping point, which I think is reasonable sometime in the next few years, that between the storage, that storage makes solar and a couple of other renewables very, very economic, then we're going to start to see real tipping points vis-a-vis coal, nuclear, and all sorts of creative destruction going on in the world of utilities. Does it threaten oil and gas? Probably not in the near term or the intermediate term, in the sense that you have such growth of demand for energy in the emerging markets. The rebalancing of the global economy is creating tremendous pressure on both, on all resources, particularly in energy, certainly one of them. Question I always get, what about free energy? I believe it exists. Not everybody agrees. That's a belief. That's not evidence. I could no more prove it in a court of law. But if you've ever studied UFOs, it's clear somebody's got it. And it's hard for me to believe that we don't have it and haven't, you know, whether we're building the UFOs or re-engineering them. Somebody's clearly got it. And they're flying around the planet with it. And the question is, when will that be allowed to spread? There's no way to know. And that gets us into some of the big questions that we'll talk about later. But if there's a rabbit that can be pulled out of the hat to keep the economy strong for a long time, it's certainly the technology that appears to exist in that area. There's no way that that technology, however, is going to be implemented unless the people who believe they control the existing governance and financial model believe they can implement it in a manner that increases their power and control. And if you look at a lot of the things that are being done to assert control globally, not just in North America, but globally, I suspect part of it is in anticipation of wanting to have the ownership of the equity locked up before that rabbit comes out of the hat. So what does this mean for you? Be prepared for a world where renewables grow in all sorts of dynamic ways, and we could get breakthrough technologies as well. So there's going to be a lot of creative destruction, lots of surprises. The potential is much lower cost of energy, which could benefit all sorts of businesses and, of course, all households if they're positioned for it. And so that means you need to keep an eye on these technologies and be prepared to deflate your business and personal energy expenses and to take advantage of it. There are a couple of great articles up on the blog. We had one on a town in Sweden. It's an island in Sweden, and then a town in Germany where communities got together, built unbelievable renewable energy sources, and now the places are very economically sound. It's a good business to be a small business in a community that comes up with that kind of strategy. And I think a lot of these strategies require that kind of community effort, and that's what makes them difficult, trying to get a community together. But where it happens, it's going, you know, there are examples of it's going wonderfully. And the more wonderful, the picture that the guys that do it present, I think the more towns that will get interested. Okay, that's it for energy. Industrial and manufacturing. In North America and the Anglo-American world, so Canada, Australia, New Zealand, this is going to be an area that is going to be tremendously dynamic and offers a lot of opportunity because there are so many new tools. It's fabrication technology, it's composite materials, it's robotics, particularly combined with artificial intelligence. The whole world of artificial intelligence and sort of quantum computing is just remarkable things are happening, you know, terrifying, but remarkable. And what is being presented is a vision of just dramatic decentralization as that automation comes into production. And I think we're going through a period when the leadership wants that decentralized development to happen and wants it to develop on a much more entrepreneurial basis. It's much more economic for lots of little guys to try stuff and build companies and the big companies buy them up. So it's a period of real opportunity and where we can integrate that technology for many good things. And the examples are thousands of them. One of my favorite is the Corning glass video that we had up when Chuck Gibson and I did the view from Silicon Valley. And Corning is making glass that darkens and lightens with the sun, so you don't need shades. The glass just knows what to do. But if you know, Corning is an example of a company that's doing a lot to integrate these different kinds of technology, and the applications are quite fascinating. I suspect one of the reasons this is happening is there are many pressures to dramatically increase the efficiency of production, but do it in a way where you don't run the risks that happen when you outsource to Asia. They're both national security risks and they're sort of corporate competition risks. So keeping it closer to home in some respects makes sense. And with the energy price coming down and this new kind of technology, suddenly highly automated manufacturing is back in the game in North America. But I also see that these are tools that household and small business can use to get much more power to do things. I just bought a new desk from a craftsman in Oregon through the website Etsy. If you haven't checked out Etsy, take a look. It's a proof that, you know, that craftsmanship can revive, and I think these tools give a lot of power to do that. One of the things that really strikes me when I look at the sort of rebuilding of the manufacturing base here in North America, I mentioned in an earlier Solari report, I did a review of two documentaries about engineering. One was called Engineering an Empire, the complete series from the History Channel. And one of the sections, it's a six-part DVD from the History Channel. One of the sections was on Carthage's effort to completely rebuild its infrastructure and re-engineer its military and navy to hold off Rome. You know, they basically said, look, if we're going to survive and keep Rome at bay, we have to completely move up tremendously in terms of productivity. And you watch the story and you feel like you're literally watching the civilization that you're a part of. Let me give you two possible explanations, some of which I've talked with Dr. Farrell about. And I think that is, if you look at the military-industrial complex, they have a real need, as we move towards a one-world government, to come up with a justification to maintain a big military-industrial complex other than war. Once you move to one-world government, yes, you need global enforcement, but you don't begin to need the kind of war machine we have. And I think a lot of the destructive things you're watching go on around the planet is military contractors and weapon makers competing for business when, in fact, there are no wars, you know, so they have to create them. Or they certainly have to create the fear of them. So I think part of the transition, we've seen tremendous development trying to interest people in space. So I think part of it is moving from a justification for big projects using war to a justification using space. Another thing is that the military-industrial complex has very much been driven by the fact that we have a huge government contracting complex that funds a lot of their business and costs, which has always been run on a cost-plus basis. And in fact, that is, you know, there are many reasons politically for it to work that way. But in fact, if you just said, look, I want to manufacture the best stuff at the lowest price, how could I do it? You've got to leave cost plus. So I think another thing is we're looking at a base or a manufacturing base that needs to really move out of that cost plus market on a much bigger component of its business. But still needs a way to centralize financial capital to keep those large pools of capital the way it's done over the last literally century. Because so much of policy, particularly government policy over the last century, has been driven by, okay, what's going to amass huge pools of capital? And I think that one of the interests in space is that desire to keep those large pools of capital amassed and working. Okay, so that's it for manufacturing and industrial. But again, I think it's going to be, in terms of our opportunities in the Anglo world, I think it's going to be a very, very dynamic area, and a lot of good stuff is going to go on. Agriculture food is one of the darkest areas to contemplate. We talk a lot on the Solari report about the fact that there is a real effort to use patents and intellectual property law to assert control of seed supply and literally all life. And there are various justifications for this, including the need to grow enough food for a growing population. But clearly there is an effort underway to industrialize the entire agriculture globally. If you haven't watched Sir James Goldsmith's video that he did in 1994, if you do a search at the blog for Sir James Goldsmith, you'll find it. You really want to watch that. It is a critical video to understanding what is happening in the breakaway economy, and it's something that's been going on for quite a while. It is very important to remember that one of the great strategic advantages of the United States is that it is an agricultural breadbasket, And a lot of the ag subsidy programs have been organized to focus agriculture in this country on producing a few agricultural crops in huge supply at low cost. So the most calories with the least costs. Part of what gives us our power is our water supply. So if you look around the world at who else has the kind of water we have on a competitive basis to keep producing this kind of amount of food, it's, you know, we're quite competitive. And I think that's one of the reasons you see a great effort over the last 10 years to aggregate ownership of farmland, including some pretty ugly things to get the small farmer to sell. And you're also, you know, I think that's why you had such a mess with Katrina in New Orleans, because if you take a look at the map and how the farming moves down through the Mississippi and into the New Orleans area port, if you're going to control agriculture in this country, you've really got to assert control of that point. It's where the heartland dumps out into the Mississippi Delta. And so it's also a crosscut for major transportation down into Latin America, both through Louisiana and East Texas. So I think part of the New Orleans story is getting control of that agriculture and heartland. One of the challenges that the breakaway civilization has and that we have with it is this effort is coming with a kind of it's coming with a sales pitch. I kind of think of it as, you know, psychopathy as slick hip. There was a great defense of GMO written in the MIT Technology Review recently. It was written by the editor. It was beautifully written. It was sort of compassion using technology to make sure 10 billion people can live on Earth. It was hard to believe that what you're reading was totally insane. It's hard to believe people can believe a lie that is that big, but there it is. And you take that article and you compare it to Jeffrey Smith's book and documentary Genetic Roulette, and you need a mental bungee rope to contemplate them together. It's quite amazing. But the nature of living in the multiple personality disorder created by the breakaway economy is that one of our biggest challenges is going to be making sure we have a fresh food supply, because even if GMO can deliver more calories, and I'm not convinced that that's the case, it can't deliver nutrition to a living intelligence. One of the challenges for us is going to be establishing and maintaining good sources of fresh food, clean water, and nutrition. You see more and more examples. I just posted up on the blog a story of a new development that is designed with an organic farm at the center. That's going to be the great new luxury good is safe food. And so, you know, if you're a developer and you want to sell a house, well, you create a development with an organic food at this farm at the center. We see all sorts of great examples of communities canceling fluoride. That's a great example of improving your health and saving money at the same time. I also believe that gruesome as they sometimes can be, robotics, agricultural robotics, there's a lot of exciting things going on in that area, and they offer a lot of potential to bring down the cost of organic food, particularly if we can learn how to use them in gardening. So again, that's a matter of the small guys getting a hold of the technology and applying it for their own purposes. Okay, that's it for food. Entertainment and media. Entertainment and media is just, to me, is a fascinating area, and an area also with a lot of opportunity, because centralized entertainment media is going to continue to be primarily, have as its overarching goal serving the investment interests, which is promoting both control through entrainment and mind control and surveillance. And the new technology, of course, means that it's much more invasive. But at the same time, you know, we all have the power to turn off a lot of it. And a lot of the entrainment and mind control doesn't necessarily always work. So the decentralization of technology and tools means much lower cost of producing music, videos, movies, software, games. So democratization keeps going on. I think for many of us, it's a matter of building more people in the population who understand the entrepreneurial process of making that financially sustainable, or supporting people who want to do that and who we want to support. So there's a sort of a development of both the entrepreneur and the consumer who supports the entrepreneur slash artist. That's what was so exciting about Kickstarter passing $1 billion this year in terms of crowdfunding to support, most of it, artists and video developers. There is a real effort now, as I said, and this was in one of the, and certainly in the manufacturing area, there's a real effort in entertaining and video to sort of let 1,000 flowers bloom, and then for the best ones to be bought up by the larger ones. So we see, you know, companies bought up by Facebook or Google, and you know, but in the meantime, they get a lot of good things done. Hollywood is really struggling. Cable is dying, although TV, to my surprise, is holding on. Although the content, talk about going to a lower mind, they just keep finding it, you know, a lower and lower mind every day. Movie theaters are in for real struggle. So, and part of that is just over capacity. So it's not clear what will emerge with 2 billion people online, but you're going to have a much bigger online market. And that means you're going to have much more support for what is called a long tail. A long tail is when you have a wide spectrum of market demand. And there's a whole long group out there on the tail who are willing to support a small volume market. So think of the Saleri Report as out on the long tail. And the more we can build lots of long tails in this market, I think the richer it can be, and the more decentralized talent will have the opportunity to rock and roll. So what does it mean to you? It means that, you know, this is an area where the market has enormous power to make authentic choices and shift things, as long as we develop a very strong immunity to sort of the entrainment and manipulation and invisible tricks that can come with some of the technology. So just be aware and make sure you look for and find the best stuff out on the end of the tail. Healthcare is extraordinarily divergent. We see with biotechnology an effort now, and, you know, it gets us into topics like transhumanism, where the extension of life and the improvement of health is extraordinary. Unfortunately, those technologies are reserved for the very rich. There are technologies like gene testing and DNA mapping, which have frightening implications for control, but also some pretty amazing implications in terms of helping people with their health. But I would just suggest to you, as I always have, you need to be very, very careful. We're in an environment where literally, there's one movie I keep finding to do on the Saleri Report about a series of murders, and the detective finally figures out that what's been happening is a transplant operation has been going around and murdering people because they fit the profile of exactly the kind of organ that they need, and they're signed up as organ donors. That's the kind of thing you get when you get digital health records that make me very nervous. The healthcare system, as I've said many times before, in America, has been re-engineered with Obamacare and the current federal policies to protect the insurance company and to protect corporate profits from the boomers aging. So we have baby boomers who've been paying money into the system for many years. Now that they're aging, they're going to start to draw money in the form of healthcare services in retirement. And this is designed to, and if they kept going on the current trajectory with the system, both insurance and corporate profits, engineered the way they are, it would basically bankrupt the country. So something has to change, but rather than reinventing it in a much more holistic and way that is really good for the for people as opposed to centralized control or centralized profits. Instead, they put into place a framework, which I would say not only diminishes the services, but to me, I think we've reached the point where hospitals and those medical systems really represent dangerous places to go. Now, they have unbelievable resources that are very important in certain kinds of situations, and I won't spend time on it tonight. We've certainly talked about it in other Salieri reports, but I think before each one of us goes into the healthcare system, we need to be very discerning consumers of what we want and what we want to get. We need to have people around us who are watching and have clear instructions, including healthcare proxies. And we need to negotiate that system with real care and understand that it is and can be a very dangerous place to be. We've been doing research on medical tourism to possibly do a Salieri report on medical tourism, because I think increasingly more and more people are going to go offshore, but are going to make concerted efforts. Some do something called concierge medicine in this country, but we're going to have to get very, very creative about doing a huge amount more for ourselves or finding places we can trust, and that may take us very far afield. But the most important practical implications for all of us is we're really going to have to be a much more intelligent, discerning consumer of healthcare, and we're going to have to shift our expenditure much more to the front end of taking responsibility for remaining healthy. That gets back to fresh food and nutrition and learning a lot about alternative methods. Next sector, commodities. The commodity super cycle. I always tell the story. It was down in the New Orleans Gold Conference, and someone asked Jim Rogers if he was concerned about peak oil. He said, forget peak oil, it's peak everything. And of course, what that means is we have 8 to 9 billion people and growing, and that's putting more stress on the natural resources, more stress on water, more stress for food. And so the theory in the commodity supercycle, which was sort of popular as commodity, the price of commodities kept going up, up, up into 2008, is that this is going to drive the prices of commodities ever higher. Now, what happened, of course, in the financial crash in 2008, commodities came roaring down. As we started to come out of that period, they started to rise, but then turned down. And it's only been since the beginning of this year that they're starting to kind of peak up. And the question is, will that continue? Big question mark. The reality is technology can have an unbelievably dramatic impact on reducing our individual footprint. So you put 2 billion people on smartphones and start using, you know, start building healthcare apps and all these other things, and you've got dramatic change in sort of how you can organize and lever intelligence vis-a-vis real natural resources. Now, that's the case, but as we turn around and watch the world, what are all the tensions around the world? There are people competing for natural resources. What are we watching in the Ukraine? We're watching a war for natural resources, whether it's the gas deposits or the gas pipeline. You know, whose gas is going to get carried into Europe? Is Russia going to control, or is Chevron going to, you know, get in there and the Americans get in there? How's that going to work? Ukraine, of course, big, huge breadbasket. So what you're watching is a war for natural resources. And I think a lot of the warfare over the last decade has been a war for resources, but not many people realized it. Many of us thought that they were natural events as opposed to warfare. I think the earthquake in Haiti was induced. I think the tsunami in Indonesia was induced. And in both cases, you're talking about corporate and private interests acquiring enormous new or asserting control over enormous new natural resources. So I think disaster capitalism at the heart of maintaining the slow burn and getting access to those commodities, and that access is managed to keep the price lower to keep the slow burn going. right now, China is dealing with reforming its shadow banking system, and that means growth has dropped from the double digits to single digits, and it looks like it may continue to slow down this year. If that's the case, it's going to help keep commodities down. But, you know, each one of us runs a household budget and has personal investments of some kind. And it's very important to remember that commodities is an enormous crosscut to both revenues and expenses throughout the economy, both our household and businesses. And so it's important to keep an eye on what is happening to commodities, because it can have a very dramatic impact. The opportunity for each one of us will be to constantly use technology and other kinds of process to re-engineer expenses down. So keep an eye out for that opportunity in your business. Education. Now I'm going to be more North America centric. We have seen the price of education in this country skyrocket, you know, way beyond inflation, way beyond anything that makes any sense. A lot of it has been fueled by student loans, which are turning out to be bad investments, because in fact, the curriculum and the sort of the investment of time and money that the student made in that educational process did not translate into a job that is sufficient or an income that is sufficient to pay off that student loan. And we're watching at the time that many people are very frustrated about the both the cost of education and the student loan situation. We're watching a revolution in online education that I think could seriously threaten a large part of the traditional university system. It's going to be very interesting to see to what extent universities re-engineer their curriculum and get a lot more relevant given the way the world is going, and re-engineer their economics and how they manage to hold on to market share. So think of it this way. We're Khan University is one of the very interesting online operations. So it's going to be interesting to see. And then, of course, we have a lot of the big Ivy Leagues putting a lot of their content up on the internet for free. So we're going to see a real competition between people who want real education as opposed to people who want certain kinds of credentials, which are helpful within, certainly as a matter of social prestige, but have traditionally been helpful in terms of getting employment or winning as an entrepreneur in the economy. It will be very interesting to see if those schools can hold on to their prestige edge. So the competition between the online world and traditional education is going to be a fascinating process, and I have absolutely no idea how it's going to come out. But one thing it's going to do is it's going to make it feasible to maintain much higher learning speeds at a much younger age than we have, including in the emerging and frontier markets. And having 2 billion people have access to all that extraordinary education and content for low cost or free, well, you know, we've never done that before in the history of civilization, so let's see how this turns out. Housing and real estate. Most of the growth of home value in the United States historically, certainly over the last 70 to 80 years, has been a combination of inflation coming from monetary policy and federal credit, plus larger homes. And of course that the federal credit and housing made it possible to do the larger homes because it provided the credit you needed to do the long mortgage and do much more in low-cost mortgage finance. The federal credit is now being withdrawn. That credit is needed, whether it's for space programs or financing the deficit. We just see a note earlier this week that announcement that Fannie and Freddie are going to be wound down. We don't know if that legislation is going to pass or go final, but we saw enormous drops in their stock. Now, they'd run up recently on speculation, so you almost wonder if it wasn't a pump and dump, but federal credit is going to have to be pulled, and so I think you're going to see one response is going to be smaller houses and houses that incorporate much more smart technology. Now, some of that technology, they call it smart, I call it stupid, I just think it's invasive, but there's also going to be new energy technology, and there's going to be a lot of technology that can integrate digital technology. I mentioned the example of the smart glass. So as you look forward and think about houses, you really want to make sure that you only use as much space as you need, because space, as that capital is withdrawn, is probably going to get relatively a lot more expensive and a lot less pleasant and enjoyable to be responsible for. Science and technology. Whenever you have a revolution in information technology, you get a revolution across the board in all different sciences, and the interaction and integration on an interdisciplinary basis. It's really sort of a cross-cutting innovation that triggers innovation in and between everything else. And I used to liken the period that we're going through to the Renaissance, because that was a time when the printing press and then the creation of double entry bookkeeping allowed tremendous innovation and communication between all different disciplines and all different places. And I think that we're seeing the same kind of thing happening again. The challenge, of course, is you get much higher learning speeds among a small percentage of the population, and suddenly they gap out and leave sort of the rest in the dust. And that's part of what we're watching in the breakaway civilization. Now, I think the breakaway civilization in part happened because you had a group of people get a hold of very powerful technology and keep it secret, and were able to then finance it with a black budget. So you have something that is a little bit more remarkable than what I know to have happened in the Renaissance. Maybe I just don't know the Renaissance as well. But what that means is you have a rise in the learning metabolism, but then you have huge gaps in the system and the rate of entropy increases. So, you know, on one hand, you have biotech extending the age for a few people in extraordinary ways, and then everybody, you know, you have this whole segment of society who can't even get healthcare. So it's a very gappy kind of thing. But what it does mean is an explosion of innovation in science and technology, and that's clearly what we're seeing. Finance is an enormous cross-cutting area, one we talk a lot about at the Solari Report, because obviously that's my greatest interest. For 500 years, the planet's been on the central banking warfare model. That is not sustainable. That depends on the first world running around and exploiting the second and third world. Instead, we're rebalancing the global economy. We're going to an integrated model. There are a couple key issues in there, and that is, you know, what's private, what's transparent. In a healthy market economy, you want the individual to have privacy, and government and shared functions to have transparency. We have the opposite. We are, with the surveillance and NSA type systems, we are completely naked to sort of a lot of the large players, both government and private. And you know, the government money and the black budget is completely private to the taxpayers. So we have a little bit of an upside down situation. We have to leave debt and equity. We've had a long-term bull market in bonds. That's over, as I discussed in the wrap-up. That doesn't mean it's over this year, but we're coming to a point where we're going to have to move to a much more equity-oriented model. Big question about how that's going to happen. Markets versus force. We're doing more and more these days with force. At some point, I don't see how you do everything with force. How do we get back to markets? Very big question. And finally, currency and payment systems. Right now, the big gold rush on the planet is who's going to be dominant in the mobile payment systems. If we're going to have 2 billion people on smartphones, then mobile payment systems are really going to handle a much larger share of the transactions. And of course, that gets us to the conversation, how do you create digital currencies? And clearly there's tremendous push underway to do that. All of these have to sort out intimately as part of the governance system, because any financial system is just a subsection of how you govern. on this planet, the financial system is much more of a incentive system and governance system than it is a sort of a system to facilitate market transactions. I think the question is, how do we move to global currency, if we are going to move to a global reserve currency, without permitting local currencies? Because if we don't permit local currencies, and if we don't have a much more market-based approach to how we manage the currencies, you're really talking about a highly centralized form of high-tech feudalism. What does this all mean to you? What it means is increasingly we're going to live on a planet, not within the U.S. market. A lot of this gets back again to the fact that the organizing consumer market is now 2 billion people on smartphones. Government has got to be re-engineered. We've been in a sovereign government model that has supported the central banking warfare model. That's being re-engineered. Now, what's going to happen is anybody's guess. A lot of it depends on whether or not we're going to go to a world run by organizations that are financed on an equity basis. If that happens, it's a very different culture. Over time, financial literacy is going to grow. Now, if you look around the world, there's tremendous financial literacy in many areas. The United States tends to be the least literate about understanding sort of the money and financial incentive systems around us. I think that with the bailout happening, that's going to tend to change. I'll give you just some examples from my little examples from my past. Once I persuaded a movie producer that the only way he could understand his industry was to buy stocks of the companies he produced for and his competitors so he could watch them. And as he started to watch them, it would start to make a lot more sense of the behavior of the people around him. I once had a woman who was running a franchise for a large corporation. I sat her down and made her read all the SEC disclosure on the company she was working for so she could understand how the executives management system worked, who they were, who the investors were, how they thought they were going to make money, how that translated into their compensation, and so why they behaved the way they did. Because I couldn't fathom that she would ever understand them without that logic. And what was interesting is, according to her, she said, oh, you know, now things make much more sense. I once had a mother, her son was very interested in sports, and I had her buy him a publicly traded football team so he could start to learn the fundamental economics behind sports. Finally, I don't know if you saw the tune up on the blog this week, but I had an ongoing squabble with our wonderful cartoonist, Bob Parsons, on the Ukraine, and taught him how to watch the U.S. dollar index and the Russian stock market and versus the U.S. stock market, as well as the stocks of the companies involved and the commodities involved, particularly wheat and oil. And I was trying to show him that there's a very different story if you watch the money than Fox News. So those are all tiny little examples of times where you try and teach people about how to understand and watch the money. But I think there's a portion of the U.S. Population that is headed toward much higher degrees of financial literacy. Transportation. One of the things you're going to see in transportation is a focus on getting both corporate goods and services and elites essentially around the planet for faster and cheaper. So what gets the leadership around faster and cheaper or more comfortably, and what gets corporate goods around the planet faster and cheaper? So we are watching talk of, you know, integrating digital technology into trains, driverless cars, ships that are drones and don't need, you know, merchant marines. So a lot of this is integrating the technology, including robotics and artificial intelligence. We see a lot of talk of sharing. So Zipcars or Uber, which is an app-based ride service out in San Francisco, or starting out of service San Francisco. And so the other, in addition to sort of getting corporate goods or elites around faster, cheaper, better, is sort of a revolution in how you organize this stuff, because the pressure coming from managing larger populations, particularly in the cities, and making density more livable, If you read the literature on driverless cars, one of the concerns is in the big urban areas, if you have, you know, a 50% increase in the population, how is that supposed to happen without many car accidents and, you know, an unbelievable amount of traffic jams? So a lot of this is in a response to making density go. The military is one of, next sector, military, one of the most challenging areas, because now you're talking about a world where you have many, many powerful weapons in many, many places, not just sovereign nations, but corporations, mafias. I think it's one of the reasons for the war on terror, you know, and of course they couldn't tell us what the real reason was, so they came up with, you know, sort of, you know, a phony baloney one. But it is very difficult. It's a very asymmetrical world. And of course, there is the UFO question. What's that about? And what is the military's response to it? If you take all these challenges of too many weapons in too many places, plus the UFO question, and you add in the existence of more and more sort of invisible tactics, whether it's mind control, Manchurian candidates, and other covert techniques or electromagnetic weapons, lasers, you start to see why anybody being responsible for security is in a very risky business and increasingly insecure business. So I think the challenges of running a centralized military capacity in this environment is sufficiently challenging that you can understand why they might want the deeply invasive digital systems and mind controls. I don't like it, but I can see in one sense why their fears could encourage them to sort of embrace that. And part of it is when you have this many people dependent on government subsidy, and we now have more than 100 million people on means-tested subsidy, when you have this many people on government subsidy, they can't afford to sort of brook any disagreement from the people they're subsidizing. They need to use all their energy to just go out and get more money for, you know, whether it's the huge capital they want for space programs or to finance the subsidy. So the more dependency there is in the system, the more fragile the system is, the more insecure the leadership. Space, I consider its own big area. Satellites are really what made globalization possible. So the reason we went to globalizing production and labor in the 90s was capital could flow into places because the satellite systems were there to enforce. Nobody puts investment where they can't enforce their terms and conditions and interests. And globalization has had a lot to do or has been made feasible by the satellite systems. Now, as we get online and the train tracks for payment mechanisms increasingly work through the internet, the satellite systems become even more important. But there's more to space than that. Obviously, there's exploration, there's mining. What the risk issues are, you know, you have various scientists who say we have a real risk of being hit by an asteroid. You know, whether any of those risk issues are driving it, I don't know. You have other people who say, well, the Earth may not go on forever. We need, if we're going to survive as a civilization, we need to establish colonies in other places. What the risks of those issues are, again, I don't know. But what is significant is that clearly the breakaway economy model in space is a private model. So government has financed extraordinary amounts of, you know, sort of the beginnings and the infrastructure of a real space effort and space exploration. And now that we're ready to proceed to the next phase, it's being shifted to a private model. One of the reasons I think that's the case is there's no way you can do this economically on a cost-plus model. SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, has been supplying the International Space Station and has been able to bring those trips in for a much lower price than what was capable under a cost-plus contract. So I think you have to go to a privatized model, and that's all part of the breakaway economy. The other thing is that space is the only thing that can garner the popular support for big capital budget projects and particularly those that require big centralized capacity. So if the leadership thinks they're going to get to one world government within some period of time, What do you need a huge war machine for? There are no wars. You got a one world government. You need enforcement, but you don't need all these weapon sales and major defense contractors. So you need a new mission, and clearly that's space. Now, interestingly enough, it's one I wholeheartedly embrace. I would love to become a space-faring civilization. The problem getting there is that what the military-industrial complex has found is that fear and force are generally better at marketing than peaceful tactics. So I had on Let's Go to the Movies the other week, the wonderful documentary Sputnik Mania, where I show the military-industrial complex trying to sort of whip Eisenhower and whip the American people using fear. And I also mentioned that wonderful documentary of the Dixie Chicks, Shut Up and Sing, which shows the sort of similar tactics of the same folks. And they're very dirtball. So, it's hard for me to imagine the military-industrial complex appealing to our more noble side. But, there is a potential for alignment here now, whether we get it or instead the marketing pitches, oh, the aliens are going to come kill us, so give us lots of money, so we'll go protect you from the aliens. Who knows? There is also, I just want to close on this, I kept encouraging subscribers last week to read Charles Smith's wonderful article on soft weapons. I think the last challenge in the military area is that invisible warfare and related economic warfare has become a bigger and bigger piece of the pie, and that includes cyber warfare. And so we now have a military that has to be able to function successfully in the invisible warfare and with the traditional warfare, and do it in a population that doesn't generally understand what's going on. And it makes it a very, very tricky position to be in. So if sometimes the Joint Chiefs of Staff look like they're under a lot of stress, they are. Arts and culture, enormous opportunities in this area. It's always, whenever you get a situation where you have this much change, particularly in investment credit, the leaders are always the artists and the musicians. They're the ones who kind of move out on the tail and on the fringe and invent the pathway forward. And the lower cost of the tools and technology means that there is an explosion in this area. What's interesting is if we do move to an equity model, it's going to be essential to real estate and business values to have the best arts and culture. You're going to see a lot more sort of connection and understanding between the local investment world and arts and cultures. And it's one of the reasons the other week I wanted to have you watch that wonderful PBS documentary, Music Makes the City, because it does a great job of explaining that. Religion is a very complex tent, because the traditional religious institutions, the churches and temples, have been both religious organizations and cultural organizations, but they've also very much been in the business of business and investment and control. The traditional religious institutions are in real trouble globally because as a result of the sort of breakdown of the central banking warfare model and the higher speeds of learning and transparency through the internet, they're having to be held accountable for a lot of the multiple personality disorder in what they say, or the difference between what they say and what they do. They have enormous staying power. They've got big endowments and investment interests, including real estate. They don't seem to have a vision of how they're going to adapt in this environment. I don't think they know. What's interesting is if you drive into a town in many places around the world, what you'll find is the local government office or courthouse, the bank, and a church or temple. And of the three, those are basically the three power centers in the place. The church really is economically dependent on building up human capital. It's their business to help the humans understand how to adapt good habits and sort of build up their human and emotional capital. And as long as they do that, I think there's going to be a role. And it's one of the reasons I've followed so carefully what the Catholic Church is up to, because they have this problem in spades, being the biggest church and the having the biggest organizational structure. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they navigate this sort of this breakaway process. Of course, with the investment interest wanting to go to a much more one world government, there's a lot of interest in going to one world religion, which I think is a perfectly insane notion. I have no idea how you get there, but and I pay very little attention to the efforts that do, because they seem to me to be ridiculous. But maybe that'll be a form of entertainment, watching how they try and engineer that. Their next sector is not-for-profits and endowments. These are critical players for the breakaway economy. When you have change, these institutions are used to both create change. So they're part of the soft weapons system. We see Soros-funded groups all over the world, you know, with their smartphones. And this is where the NSA system is critical. So they spread money around and encourage them to sort of sabotage existing institutions. A second is managing dissent. Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, was a great example. They have a role in disaster capitalism, kind of soaking up and keeping all the dissenters busy. And it's kind of a way of doing the reengineering without letting the people harmed, kind of, you want to channel them in a way that certainly doesn't mess up your plans or can even help your plans. And finally, they're a way to pull enormous capital. So we see the big not-for-profit players. So you see Buffett and Gates putting a lot of their money into a endowment that is a pool of intergenerational capital that can be used very, very strategically and protected from taxation. So it's a very efficient way for the syndicate to manage and control money. But think of them as strategic players that are very much a pincer movement with the effort to sort of re-engineer, whether it's a sector or a place. Some of these institutions have been very major players in pushing and promoting GMOs throughout the third world. Geography. Okay, so that's it for sectors. Let's turn to geography and what the breakaway economy means for place, because place is going to be a very big component of this process. For a long time, we've lived in a world where the financial system and the environmental ecosystem are not organized to be in alignment, and that's slowly going to change. The first thing that, of course, that happened is we went to a rebalancing of the global economy, and as a result, we developed equity markets, stock markets around the world, and then went through a process where we created the exchange-traded fund industry, and the exchange-traded fund made it possible to buy much more liquid vehicles to invest in stock markets around the world. And through that process, you're seeing capital flow into ETFs and from the ETFs into the local stock markets. And we're literally watching the equity globally be securitized in a way that we can now trade places. So, for example, as the squabble goes on in the Ukraine, you can watch how the Russian ETF trades. And you can watch all sorts of dynamics of the different commodities and companies impacted. So we literally are building a global economy and financial system where we can trade places. Now, right now, it's organized around sovereign nations. And what's interesting, as you look at sort of a world where we now see places trading and competing, you see the enormous challenge for the Anglo-American world, which has long been dominant. The Anglo-American world has been the leaders in the central banking warfare model for 500 years. How the challenge for them is, if they're going to rebalance the global economy, how do they stay dominant when China has 1 billion people and growing? And the history of China is they've always had a remarkable both science and technology and economic prowess. So if you're the Anglo-American world, how do you rebalance the global economy and not get outpowered by the demographics? And I think much of what has happened over the last 20 years in the financial coup was really the Anglo-American alliance repositioning their capital and themselves so that they wouldn't get overpowered and outpowered by Asia in that process. And I think their argument would be, okay, well, we did the coup because we needed to reposition capital to win in space. You know, winning in space is essential to winning on the planet because now you've got to control the satellite lanes and the sea lanes, and they would argue you've got to put up and ring the Earth with space weapons if they're going to continue to be dominant. So they would say, okay, we've got to reposition the retirement capital to win in space and win in the global rebalancing instead of paying for nursing homes. And then, in fact, the people who are now having their retirement savings debased are going to be better off for them having done it or not. Now, you know, I have a lot of disagreement with exactly that, but that's a topic for another day. What I would say is the big opportunity before us, because it is what it is the reinventing of the financing of places. If you read the Dylan Reed story, this was something I worked on tremendously during the 1990s. And one of the things I discovered, I was able to build databases where I took all the government data investment in the country and was able to use relational databases to look at it by place. So to look at it within a congressional district, to look at it within a zip code. What I discovered was that if you re-engineer government investment to optimize government investment by place, at the same time that you integrate this new technology, what people are now calling the Internet of Things, or what I call the digital heartland in the wrap-up. I talked a lot about this in the wrap-up. And that includes reinventing the production and manufacturing on a decentralized basis. And it includes allowing capital to flow and be traded so that, imagine you have a mutual fund or a community venture fund for your place, and you can, you know, you can invest in it through your IRA or 401k, or you can just buy in the stock market. So if you do all those things at the same time, there's tremendous equity that can be created. What's interesting is the logical players to help lead and capitalize this are the local and regional banks in combination with the public pension funds. The public pension funds have a deep understanding of their places and enormous pools of capital and are very knowledgeable about the investment process. And I suspect one of several reasons that you have various billionaires running around screaming and attacking and financing think tanks to attack the public pension funds is the billionaires are lining up to take advantage of this place-based reengineering. They clearly see the financial opportunity, and they want the pension funds to finance them, and they want to stop from getting the local state and local government civil service teamed up with the pension funds and dominating the situation, because, in fact, this could be a tremendous way to kind of sort of rejuvenate the value of the public pension funds. And the interesting thing about it is when these kinds of reengineering happen, where they're successful, it's also going to create more employment. So it's sort of a win-win for everyone. But I suspect the billionaires want the control and they want the public pension funds financing them and not, you know, teaming up with the local guys and doing it themselves. But suffice it to say, the opportunity is pretty big, but I think that's why you see people like Warren Buffett attacking the public pension funds as being a tapeworm. He's being a tapeworm. The model of place-based development is aligning the living ecosystem with a financial ecosystem. And, you know, there was tremendous political opposition to doing that in the 90s, and that's because the large companies wanted those income flows and assets running through their income statement and balance sheet. So the question is, well, why would they let it happen now? Well, because you've sucked a lot of capital out. You've gotten control of a lot of the real estate, which is the big play. But the other thing is you have the NSA sort of surveillance systems and smart meters and all that in. So I think the leadership feels that they have much more sort of invisible control and soft weapon control. The opportunity, as I said, technology is going to be very deflating of things like energy costs. as that cost cheapens, the cost of maintaining real estate is lower and real estate rises in relative value. And I've always believed that the anticipation of integrating new technology and reengineering government was exactly why they pumped and dumped the housing market, because they saw the opportunity to reengineer the whole sort of infrastructure within places and realize that the big money was going to be made on the real estate. And so pumping and dumping the real estate in a way that you get ownership and control of a lot of real estate for essentially no money. In fact, you make money getting control of it, that it was just too juicy to pass up for. And so if you want to get a better sense of how this might look, when I went up to Detroit a year or two ago, I did a Solari report on sort of some of the place-based reengineering opportunities. Right after that, Popular Mechanics did a layout on sort of the greening of Detroit that was very interesting and showed some of the different applications. Anyway, it looks to me like the early prototypes are being set up now. If you want to keep an eye on it, keep an eye out for where the feds are pumping in different kinds of grants based on zone. I think they used to call them enterprise zones. Now they call them prosperity zones. Some of this will be done through HUD, but there'll be other agencies involved. Also watch where the Gates Foundation is active, particularly in places that have been devastated by the housing pump and dump. So you have the feds throwing in big money, players like the Gates Foundation being active, throwing in money as well. And then you have institutional investors who picked up big, big housing positions, particularly rental housing, which they can turn around once they package and flip out to other investors. Looks to me like two of the places on the list are New Orleans and Philadelphia. Those are ones that sort of fit the description, but there are others. I think this is going to, you know, be a 5 to 10 year process. So there's going to be a lot of opportunity. And you might want to keep an eye out to see if it's going to be going on in your area. Okay, investors' general rules of thumbs. These are some very generalized comments because everybody's different. In an environment like this, what you've got, we've got a situation where, as I've said before, studies show that 40 to 50% of the existing jobs in the economy are going to be automated, and I would say probably over the next 5 to 10 years. What that means is just everybody listening to this call, what you need to do is assume that 50% of your income gets automated out of existence, and you need to constantly reinvent your sources of income in a way that not only replace that, but use what's going on to invent more. And what that means is you've got to use your intellectual and emotional capital to continuously create more value than the slow burn can sort of harvest or compete away. It's very interesting. If you watch how the Chinese, if you've ever spent any time in China, you can see a population that sort of acts that way. So you want to think about constantly staying abreast of what's going on and jumping the curve. It's not just intellectual knowledge. It's not just learning technology. It's also emotional intelligence about how to collaborate and work with other people, because this is an environment where winning really requires enormous amounts of listening to other people and learning how to work effectively with other people. So it requires an enormously high emotional IQ. This is an environment where it is essential to be diversified and liquid. Please do not bet the ranch on anything unless you have clear spiritual guidance to do so. Since I sometimes do so, I can't say never do it. Change means uncertainty. There are an enormous amount of wild cards. And what's been interesting is if you look at the equity markets here in the United States, they've been very, very strong. But as I said in the wrap-up and in the recent equity overview, there's been tremendous divergence inside of the market. So you have some companies getting, you know, jumping the curve and very much part of the new technology, and others falling vastly behind. And the creative destruction is extraordinary and often unexpected. And part of it is you have economic warfare and things that are unexpected. So it's very hard to predict. Anything can happen, and anything can happen to one company or one endeavor. One of the distinct possibilities, if you look at the chart that we showed recently in the was in the wrap-up of the price-earnings ratio in the history of the S&P 500 in the United States for the U.S. equity markets. Two times we've had enormous equity market bubbles. One was in the 20s, and the other was coming into 2000, the tech bubble. Both of them I would describe as technology bubbles. And if you look at the kind of technology that will be coming out over the next 5 to 10 years and what it could do for corporate profits, particularly with continued globalization, we literally have the potential for a crash up in the stock market. Now, one of the problems corporations are going to be dealing with is the kind of deflation you can get. Yes, they can get deflation in their expenses, but they can get enormous deflation in their revenues as well. One thing that would be great for everybody in this situation is decentralization of capital. That's why I've talked so much about crowdfunding on the Solari report. But, so far that hasn't happened. It has happened with crowdfunding that does not involve equity securities. So again, we see Kickstarter announce that they've just passed $1 billion. It's almost like we decided, fine, you won't let us buy stock in each other. Fine. We'll just give each other, we'll just invest. You put $1 in my company, I put $1 in your company, you keep your stock, I keep my stock, we just do it all with gifting. It's kind of pretty cool. But decentralization of capital could help tremendously. Of course, then there's the question of that makes us harder to control. Pay attention to politics. This is not a market economy. If you're going to be financially literate, you have to understand that there's enormous and intimate connection between government and politics and business. Don't waste time on the collapse issues. One of the reasons I spent as much time this year on the wrap-up is to create a framework that could show you, the financial coup d'etat was engineered to make sure that the breakaway power players had enough capital so no matter what happened, there would be no collapse and they would be dominant. Now, they're systematically going around the world and collapsing different places or different groups of people. So collapse is happening, but it's not great big bang collapse. It's literally tapeworm composting on a systematic basis. So don't waste time on collapse, because while you're anticipating or we're anticipating collapse, the breakaway players are running around. It makes it much easier for them to buy everything up for cheap. That's number one. And don't waste time on anger. One of the things that we all need to deeply appreciate is that what has happened over the last 5 to 10 years is the first 10% of the change that we're in the process of going through. You need all your time and energy for the next 50% because you ain't seen nothing yet. This is just the beginning. So we can sit around and be angry that the official reality is not true and yell at the puppets because they didn't tell us. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do some of that. But what is the most important is you need to understand this is just the beginning. We have the next 90% coming. How are you going to be successful in that environment? That's what I want you to think about. Okay. That's it for opportunities and risks. Okay, so let's turn to the second part, household income, employment, and standard of living in the developed world, the $64,000 question. The rebalancing of the global economy has created enormous opportunities in the emerging markets and the frontier markets. Now, those opportunities have not been even, and there's been a great deal of pain. So I don't mean to imply that the emerging markets have had a wonderful time of it. There have been great and horrible difficulties. At the same time, there is no doubt that the labor and the average person in the developed world has experienced a stalling of standard of living and a diminution of standard of living. And it certainly looks like it's going to get worse. because their labor markets are now being competed against the emerging and frontier markets globally. And as I said, I believe that 40 to 50% of the currently existing jobs will probably go away in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, lots of new jobs are going to be created, but if you look at the current labor force in North America, those jobs are not necessarily going to match up with the existing skill set. And much of the new technology will not create new jobs, but will give households the ability to decrease costs and expenses. So, as I said earlier, that means we have to all be savvy about taking advantage and sort of riding that expense curve down. But the technology can be very deflationary, and incomes will or could fall as costs fall. And if income falls faster than your costs fall, then you get what that's part of the phenomena I call the slow burn. Now, globalization continues, and now it's cutting into the white collar and, you know, sort of traditional voter population much more than ever before. One of the things I've often tried to understand is sort of what is Mr. Global's plan? If you're going to let loose globalization like this and technology like this, then you're literally going to take an enormous population of people and turn them in from sort of healthy middle-class people to sort of impoverished people in a high-tech feudalism. Clearly, one plan is to simply pay people a government stipend. I think the feeling is it's easier to pay them a small amount of money to cover their living expenses than to involve them in the economic process. So let us use automation to manufacture and do everything, and we'll take a portion of the profits and just give you a check and you go over here and don't bother us. But I also think there's a darker picture here. We see a steady diminution of fertility and life expectancy. I think there's going to be enormous pressure to increase the retirement age. That's how you rebalance the Social Security fund. So if life expectancy drops and the retirement age rises, then, you know, at some point you get a rebalancing. You will see a lot of scare stories on the internet about FEMA camps and sort of overt control. I think that's all a bunch of hooey. I'm not saying that, you know, if you're the government, you don't have to be prepared for the worst case. But the reality is that covert control is far more economic and has been far more successful. I once did an interview with John Rappaport where we referred to the sort of the reinvention of this, the Nazi system, as sort of Hotel Auschwitz. And I think the Hotel Auschwitz model is much more economic and popular. As I said before, I do think Obamacare was set up to sort of liquidate the boomer problem and give them a framework as the boomers became non-economic to the system. If you look, you know, one of the great blessings of Snowden educating us all to the surveillance systems is I've tried for many years to explain how the surveillance systems work in terms of economic warfare and keeping the slow burn going. What you need to understand is that the management of the unemployment problem has been very deeply granular one-on-one. I would say that between the surveillance systems and sort of the local secret societies, this is very much dealt with on a one-by-one basis. You know, households are harvested on a one-by-one basis. So as the unemployment happens in a town, you see, well, you know, this person can be supported by their spouse because it turns out their spouse can keep their job or they have family money. These five don't have any way to support themselves and their family can't support them. So they deal drugs and meth kills three of them. And, you know, one ends up in prison in the mental hospital, which is a good business because you can fund that with government. One, it turns out, is very deeply committed to their church, and the congregation will support sending them to Brazil to do ministry where they can work for very little money. Some of them go, you know, maybe five go on Social Security disability. In the meantime, the food supply gets poorer and poorer, and toxicity levels get higher and higher, And as the weather gets weirder, you know, a couple of people die off in their capital or houses drop to their kids, which is good because the kids are struggling to pay student loans. Or sometimes the kids to, you know, go off into the military. They're very much targeted for recruiting by the military. They have big student loans and the military promises they'll pay off their student loans and or their parents' debt. And then the kids get killed in Iraq. And so what you watch is you watch all of this being dealt with on a one-by-one level. It's almost as though the system is really harvesting people one person at a time. And it's, as I said before, one wonderful ally said to me, well, there's no way they can listen to more than 25,000 people at a time. Ridiculous. They can listen to everybody. That's where the artificial intelligence comes in. If you look at what we were doing with relational databases in the early 90s and what can be done with those and artificial intelligence, when you can fund it with the government and the government has the ability to suck in all the data, it's quite remarkable because, you know, it is absolutely correlated and managed, that kind of intelligence, with the ability to implement in places. And every place, every county is networked in that kind of extraordinary way. You make no mistake about it. You know, we have one of the most over-networked countries in the, probably in the galaxy. Of course, Facebook and social media take it to a whole new level. If you, if you're the government, you found a way to make money having people update their dossier and explain their connections to you and all their preferences, you know, on their time, and you don't have to pay for it. It's quite remarkable. And so it really, you know, in a sense, we really have created the equivalent of what you see in the movie, The Truman Show. It's a little bit frightening. The big rabbit they can pull out of the hat in all of this, if the unemployment thing becomes unbearable, is they can pull free energy out of the hat, is what I believe. And I think if it gets bad enough, the pressure to lower the cost of energy will become extraordinary, even though what they would argue is that's going to encourage much bigger families and a much bigger sort of resource problem for the whole planet. One of the reasons that they want, I think, the sort of the carbon tax and those kinds of systems is that will give them unbelievable control at the resource use and at the household level. It's pretty frightening what that might look like. So I don't know if they have a plan. I think on this one, they're kind of making it up as they go along. Now, what does this mean to us? The 2014 elections are coming up, and as I've said before, this is going to be a very creative space because people are the traditional voter who is a very well-educated and responsible person, works very hard, has always been supportive of the system, you know, has been patient, has been a good soldier. That person is very, very angry about the corruption and very, very angry about what's happening to household income around the country. And so I think the big issue this election is going to be jobs, jobs, jobs. So it'll be interesting to see the discussion of what the, you know, what the exit plan is. And I think it's a real opportunity to begin to have that conversation. I would look around you and say, okay, where is the opportunity for me to engage with the people around me to, on an entrepreneurial basis, create new income, create new jobs, take this technology and create opportunity for all of us? And one of the places is absolutely going to be in place-based development. Okay, so let's turn to the next section. What are Mr. Global's goals? This is the big mystery. That's why we started off with who's really running this. Clearly, we have, I just went back and was reading a book about the creation of Area 51 and the squabbles between Eisenhower and Kennedy and the group that ran the black budget, which was really the group that sort of financed and built up the breakaway civilization. The question is, you know, what is driving this group? Why are they behaving the way they behave? I keep getting back to the big questions about who's in charge. What are they afraid of? Why are they behaving the way they're behaving? And what are their goals? And I don't think we know. But I do think we can know. And I think it's one of the reasons I've had Richard Dolan and Joseph Farrell on the Solari Report, and we've been talking about that. It's clear they want more control. It's clear they want to consolidate capital. It's clear they're running a harvesting system through the financial system. You know, this whole planet is producing an enormous tithe, and I, for one, would like to know where it's going. Again, as I said earlier, if you look at the documentary from the History Channel, Engineering and Empire, it certainly looks like we're amassing mighty amounts of capital with the financial coup d'etat to build a much more advanced infrastructure and manufacturing base. It's almost like we're trying to take a society and say, okay, on an accelerated basis, we're going to go from primitive to advanced. We don't think everybody can come with us, so we're just going to take 10% and, you know, and maybe we'll put some hope on the kids. So if you look at what's driving these folks, there is a logical explanation for what they're doing and how they're doing it. And the question is, what's the logical explanation? And I continue to do my best to get to the bottom of it. But I think it's very important to understand that until we can sit in Mr. Global's shoes and look at the risks he's dealing with and what's driving his plan, we don't know. And we need to hold that uncertainty. Okay, final section, the strategic choice. As I said, there are two cross-cutting themes to everything that's happening in the breakaway economy. One is consciousness, and the other is technology. Now, to a certain extent, I should put technology first, because it's part of what's triggering the changes. At the same time, I think by and far and away, the most important choice is consciousness. As I said, you get 2 billion people on smartphones talking to each other, and you have a whole different field. You have a whole new psychic storm. And I think, you know, I made a little chart with four boxes, so four quadrants. And in the top two rows, I put higher mind and lower mind. So think of the continuum of consciousness from the lowest mind to the highest mind. And then in the two columns, I put high tech and low tech. And so it creates four boxes. You can be higher mind or lower mind. You can be higher tech or low tech. And that creates sort of four states of the combination of the two. And of course, you know, it's not just two states. There's a continuum of technology and a continuum of consciousness. And I think the fundamental question here, and it's one Mr. Global does not control, he's powerful and he influences, but he does not control. And that is, there are 9 billion of all of us, or there will be, you know, within some reasonable period of time, which box are we going to go to? And that's a choice that each one of us can make. And what's interesting is that if each one of us goes to as high a mind as possible, it has the power to shift everything. Everything. Now, why do I bring that up? One of the things that I struggle with every day is I see so many people who are fighting backwards. They're angry about the fact that the official reality that we all believed in turned out to be not true. They're angry that the financial coup d'etat happened. And as I said before, they're angry about the first 10% of what has happened. What we all need to understand is, I'm not saying don't be angry about that. What I am saying is it's just begun. There's the next 90%. And what I want on the Solari Report is I want for every one of you, as best we can, to see what's coming and jump the curve on it. Because I want you to thrive in the breakaway economy. And of course, as you know, I don't think we have to thrive in the breakaway economy that Mr. Global's creating. I think we can take the tools, we can take the dynamic, we can take the ability to communicate and market to 2 billion people all over the world, you know, and we can also build the kind of breakaway economy we want to. You know, there's going to be lots of stuff breaking away, you know, and we can grab the, you know, when the Titanic sinks, we can grab some deck chairs and some planks and start to build arcs. So I don't think we have to go with the flow here, but I do think it is absolutely critical to stay in the highest mind possible. And then pick the continuums on the technology continuum where you want to be, and there are lots of reasons. You may want low tech, you may want high tech. It's just as you use the technology, it's very, very important to use it with discernment and understand that the people who created it or who may be able to access it in secret do not necessarily have your best interests at heart. And if you know, on that continuum of higher and lower mind, it is absolutely essential to be successful in this economy that we do not lose our coherence. Coherence and maintaining your coherence is about as important as it gets. When I did the Salieri Report with William Tiller, it was a magical moment when I asked him what he thought of community prayer. And he said, well, you know, if the people doing it are coherent, it helps. If they're not, it makes things worse. And that's when I realized, oh, you know, the number one thing I can do for the people around me is to try and stay coherent. So I think you need to think about where on that spectrum of consciousness and technology you want to be. And let's say you want to be, you know, towards the higher mind. Here's what you need to know. There are, and certainly Mr. Global is encouraging a lot of the population to go to the lower mind. If you're in a higher mind quadrant, working with, dealing with, interacting with people in the lower mind is going to be very draining. And so you need to think very carefully about the tricky part of this change. If you're not going to fall into a lower mind, how do you manage your interaction with family, friends, colleagues that do? And again, you know, understand that there's a lot of money and power pushing them to go there. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have again this week, two movies I brought up in 2011. We've done them on the Salieri Report before, The Never Ending Story, the first one, and then the second part. In The Never Ending Story, you have a wonderful young protagonist who visits a fantasy world called Fantasia. And in Fantasia, Fantasia is being destroyed by a force called the Nothing. And as the Nothing goes through Fantasia, it destroys meaning. As it destroys meaning, Fantasia slowly falls apart. And it's the job of the young hero to stop the Nothing, which he does, but I can't tell you how. I don't want to give it away, so you're going to have to watch The Neverending Story, both the first part and part two. But that is our challenge. The challenge that the young hero in Neverending Story faces is the one you and I face. And that is, how do we remain coherent? Because when you have an economy that is changing this radically, and the fields, the human fields changing this radically, then it is very difficult to maintain your intellectual integrity and your emotional coherence. You're going to be dealing with enormous lies and propaganda that seem overwhelming and have literally can at times become the Nothing, destroying people, destroying communities, destroying, you know, connection and cultures that we love. So to deal with that and to remain coherent with that, it's essential you see the world as it is. And that, I'm afraid, means avoiding the people who go to the lower minds and really finding ways of engaging with people in the higher mind to seek and nourish the kind of life and meaning that you want to have. Now, I struggle with what that means specifically for you, because each one of us is different. What it means to you tomorrow, and your time and money tomorrow varies tremendously with what it might mean to me or somebody next to me. But I will tell you this, that in this case, and in an environment like this, it matters tremendously what you do and how you use the opportunities that are before you, because just as lots of doors are closing, lots of doors are opening too. It's fluid. As I said before, Mr. Global has a lot of power and influence, but nowhere near as much as you and I and all the living things and intelligence on the planet. And if I could close with sort of one watchword for functioning in the breakaway economy. It would be a wonderful line from Leonard Cohen's newest album. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for Breakaway Economy Part 2. Good night and good luck.